Blog Talk Radio.
Pleased to welcome our guest to this week's program. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, activist, journalist, and blogger. He's a co-editor of one of the greatest sites ever, Boing Boing, and he also blogs at his own site, which has one of the greatest names ever, craphound.com. He is a contributor to Wired, Popular Science, Make, the New York Times, as well as a number of other newspapers, magazines, and websites. He is the former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he is co-founder of the UK Open Rights Group. He has also recently been listed by Forbes as one of the top 25 web celebs, a list to which he is no stranger. Cory's best-selling novel, Little Brother, was nominated for the 2008 Hugo, Nebula, Sunburst, and Locus Awards. His current novel, which we'll be discussing with him today, is called Makers, and it's available in bookstores now. Cory Doctorow, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Stephen and I were just talking before we called you about how much we both have enjoyed reading Makers. I think it's one of the just most pleasurable reading experiences I've had in, I'm going to say, a couple of years, just in terms of a really fun novel to read and at the same time dealing with, I think, some really important issues and opening our eyes to some really interesting possibilities of what's coming soon.
Cool. Well, you know, it's hard to disagree with that sentiment as the author. I'm very glad to hear it. You won't get any controversy here.
All right. Well, one of the things that we've observed is a similarity between what's happening with kind of this Makers Revolution and some things that have that have gone on in the recent past. Stephen, I thought you had some interesting thoughts about that.
Well, you know, with the Internet, things went crazy for a while. We had our dot-com boom and then bust. And well, I guess the question is, do you foresee something similar with making, whatever we choose to call it today, with the using Fab Labs or Rep Raps or whatever, where there's a boom of people throwing money into it, seeing the potential, and then all of a sudden there's a problem that we have to step back. Do you see us having to repeat history again?
Well, you know, so Makers was written as a kind of parable about the dot-com boom and bust, which I lived through. I was living in San Francisco from about 1999 on, and so I got there right at the peak of the boom. I remember getting there, and the only apartment I could find was the back half of half an illegal sublet on Petrero Hill, and I was paying $1,900 a month for it, and the guy in the back was living in a Sears shed, and he was paying $800 a month for it. It didn't have a toilet, but it did come with a parking spot for his Jag, because he was like he was you know, some big mucky muck in some new startup. So that's kind of what the boom was like at its peak. And then, you know, it was maybe 6 months later that I was walking down the street and I found someone selling literally, like, as far as the eye could see, hundreds of steel case leap chairs, which are, you know, these $1,400 beautiful chairs. And it was basically make an offer going back to the Midwest tomorrow. So I saw the boom, I saw the bust, and I lived through both. And the amazing thing to me was what happened after the bust, which is that kind of like the Who's in Whoville after the Grinch Steals Christmas, people kept on making stuff. And I think if there's a prediction in Makers, it's that. It's that the reason that people make stuff, and the reason that people made the web, was only kind of marginally related to money. I think what the money in the system did, it's not that people are doing it because they're, you know, altruists or whatever, but I think what the money in the system did was it provided the capital to retrain a bunch of humanities majors as HTML jocks and Perl people, basically, in the form, you know, by turning pension funds into venture capital, into doomed startups that hired, you know, university dropouts as quickly as they could and taught them HTML as quick as they could. And what that meant was you kind of bootstrap technology literacy at the expense of a bunch of high net worth individuals and institutional shareholders and contributors to venture capital funds. And I think that that may happen with making as well. I think that the fundamental disconnection between the web and the way that we do high-tech venture capital, specifically high-tech venture capital, is that high-tech venture capital is really accustomed to very capital-intensive industry, right? It starts with semiconductors. It's kind of hard to imagine an industry that's more capital-intensive than microchip fabrication. You know, you need these huge facilities. They cost upwards of $1 billion. The development of a chip is an insane amount of work and very specialized and so on. And you know, if you get it right, well, you sell a lot of chips, right? I mean, a successful chip ends up everywhere. You know, I actually heard Werner Vinge, the science fiction writer, give a talk a little while ago saying the fact that all of our chips are made more or less the same way with more or less the same architecture these days is itself a kind of existential risk to the future of humanity, because something that we can't foresee that kind of architecture and that kind of fabrication is vulnerable to could have enormous effects. I mean, imagine all the microchips, you know, didn't work or couldn't be made anymore because something happened that they were vulnerable to. So, you know, that's the traditional economics of high-tech venture capital. You put in a couple of billion and then whatever you make, everybody in the world buys 9 of them. And that's great for that kind of industry. But the web, and I think 3D printing and artisanal making, almost by definition has none of that stuff. You know, the key word here being artisanal. The thing that makes the best of the web great is how handcrafted it is, how it isn't scaled up. And sometimes it does scale in terms of its readership. You know, you can get very big readerships for things that are very hand-turned, like Boing Boing, where almost everything you see on Boing Boing, except some of our ads, is kind of touched by human hands and individually chosen and put there. But nevertheless, it doesn't hit the kind of economic scale that makes taking in a bunch of capital worthwhile. If you're going to make a risky bet on something as weird and dumb as 3D printing, you want a really big payout, like, you know, 50 to 1, 100 to 1. And I just don't think that you get those 100 to 1 payouts on $1 million investments or $10 million investments in 3D printing, where that investment is in someone who's got an idea for something to do with a 3D printer. Instead, I think you could probably get 100 to 1 out of a business if you put in $10 and, you know, what came out of it was $1,000, because I can imagine someone with a 3D printer on their desk making and selling goods that turned a net profit of $1,000 over a reasonable amount of time. But I don't know what you do, what you give someone with a 3D printer on his desk $10 million to do, and I certainly don't know how that turns out to be $1 billion. So, yeah, we might get that kind of overheated bubble again.
It's interesting in the book, and I'm sorry, I have to go back just 1 second. Did you say a Sears shed, a shed purchased from Sears, and you got a guy who owns a Jag living in it? I just wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah, because it came with a parking spot, right? And so parking spots in Potrero Hill at that time were something like $600 or $700 a month, if you could find one. So it was really worth it for him, I think. And he didn't mind, I guess, sharing the toilet with the guy who lived downstairs if he could park his Jag.
Man, amazing.
I mean, bubbles are insane. Bubbles are completely I mean, they're. This is why they're such good grist for fiction, is because when a bubble catches hold, people go crazy. The book that I've just finished writing, For the Win, recounts a fictionalized version of a real-world cognitive or behavioral economics experiment where a researcher gives everybody in the room a poker chip, and he says, okay, I'm going to come back once an hour, and if you're however many poker chips you're holding on to, I'm going to give you $10, and I'm going to do this for 8 hours, and then your poker chips won't be worth anything. And you can do whatever you want. And what happens is almost always you get a bubble where people start buying each other's poker chips off of them, but not for, like, the rational amount of money, because you can calculate the total value of that poker chip, right? It's however many hours are left in the experiment times $10, but for more than that amount of money, you know,
right.
And people are like, you know, and there's people, like, in the last 2 hours going, I own all the poker chips. And the fact that they spent more than those poker chips are going to realize over their entire life is kind of orthogonal to the satisfaction that they get out of having cornered the market on something whose value is about to disappear and everybody knows it. I mean, we have a huge cognitive blind spot that makes these bubbles common and maybe even inevitable.
Fascinating stuff. And it's interesting because we get we ultimately feel the pain from those, but we, as you pointed out, we get the benefit of those as well. One question I have for you to wind it back a little further, going back before the dot-com bubble, because the comparison I would make between with the maker revolution would actually be to take it back to the hacker revolution, as Stephen Levy described in his book Hackers. And I almost read Makers as kind of a sequel to Hackers. Is that in any sense a valid reading, or is history a sequel to history, or is your book in some sense a science fiction novel that's a sequel to a history book?
Well, I think that, yeah, there is some connection there in that I said at the beginning that the reason that people do this isn't necessarily money. The reason they do it is in part, you know, we call it this hacker ethic. It's the satisfaction you get out of regarding something in the world that is somehow less than optimal for your needs and putting it to right. And, you know, there's just something deeply humanly satisfying about that. And I think, you know, I think arguments from evolutionary psychology are always a little bit suspect. But it seems to me likely that the organism that rearranges the world so that it suits it better is apt to be fairly successful. And we are almost certainly all of us descended from organisms that pursue that in part as its strategy. So I think that we just like making the world more us-shaped, better suit, you know, where the void better suits our 3D protuberance so that we kind of rub up against it very nicely. And so I guess that's the hacker ethic too, right? Taking it apart just because you can and putting it back together in a way that suits you more. You know, the why do you climb Mount Everest? Because it's their school of technology. And yeah, I certainly see between 3D hackers, hardware hackers, and makers in general, the same kind of thing. There's a certain power that comes from realizing that the thing that you thought of as permanent and fixed and inevitable is in fact totally contingent, and you can pull it apart and put it back together to suit your needs.
One of the interesting things that gets hacked in Makers, a problem that gets ostensibly solved, is outside of the technology realm completely, and that is one of the really cool ideas that gets. Say again, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I said, well, not completely. It's not completely outside the realm of technology, but yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, outside of computer technology is obesity gets cured, and this of course is a topic very near and dear to myself. Stephen doesn't worry about it so much; he's just more big bone. But now
I think we all worry.
I look at this this kind of counter plot about curing obesity, this kind of additional story that's going on, and I wonder. How the two ideas relate together. Is obesity kind of part of the dark underbelly of abundance, kind of a downside that gets played out on an individual and societal level to the same factors that allow us to have all this stuff that you can, you know, build interesting things out of the leftovers with?
Yeah, I think that the key word out of that there is abundance, right? Obesity and abundance go hand in hand, and it's a different kind of problem to contend with. You know, just like everybody else, I'm worried about my weight. I used to be a lot bigger. I lost 80 pounds, and it wasn't easy, and
wow.
Keeping it off isn't easy either.
Good
so, yeah, I certainly weight's something that we all worry about. And I think, you know, we're not really sure exactly why obesity is on the upswing. I mean, I think a lot of us think that it's a combination of technological factors, though, between the sedentary lifestyle and the industrialization of food production to create what some people have called hyperpalatable foods. And the idea of hyperpalatability is you take something that we crave in because it's scarce in nature, like sweets or fats or salt, and that we need in some measure to stay alive, and that we have evolved to really want lots of and to take advantage of when it's present because it isn't always there. So when you find it, you kind of gas up on it. We've taken that and we figured out how to industrialize it so that we can produce it in great abundance, and in ways that kind of produce this very toxic positive feedback loop where the more hyperpalatable food you eat, the more hyperpalatable food you want. So eating something with a lot of fat and sugar and salt in it makes you want to eat a lot of fat and sugar and salt, particularly sugar, crashes your metabolism and makes you want to eat some more. And this is a kind of bad technological outcome, kind of law of unintended consequences of the way that we industrialize food and the way that markets work. And the classic technological answer to something that technology broke is to add more technology, right? Well, it's the geoengineering school of climate mitigation, for example, right? Has runaway carbon endangered the climate? I know. We'll just take this thing that we have created as an outgrowth of our engineering, and we'll use more engineering to solve it. There's certainly something to that, but it's always easier not to put toxic waste in the water supply than it is to remove it later. And by the same token, presumably it would be easier for some values of easier to figure out how not to eat industrial waste than it would be to figure out how to remove the flab that it generates. But in the book, that's not what they do, because the real politic of things like food is that it's really, really hard to do the thing that's quote easier, right? To not put it on in the first place, to change the way that you eat. And mitigation strategies are way more profitable ultimately, and markets seem to really reward people who have mitigation strategies over people who have prevention strategies. And so you have these characters who are going off and they're doing things to their metabolism that turn their metabolism up to 15,000 calories a day. That sounds like a good idea when you start, and then you start to get into the side effects, which aren't just biological. Some of them are economic. Like, where do you get 15,000 calories a day without going broke? Because that's a lot of calories, right? And they're guzzling high fructose corn syrup slurry, in an effort to keep from starving to death. And I think that there's a nice little set of parallels to some of the pathological things we do with technology there, and it makes a good counterpoint to some of the utopian stuff in the book. I also think that obesity is a really juicy narrative or fictional subject because we got so much morals tied up in obesity, right? The whole question of, are people fat because they're lazy? The kind of dumb pat advice that people will evince whenever someone starts talking about fat. It's kind of the Godwin's law of fat. Someone will say, oh, you should just eat less and exercise more. Discussion about obesity includes the phrase that you should eat less and exercise more, the discussion is over, just like any discussion about politics that includes a comparison to the Nazis is over. It's the world's most pointless bit of nutritional advice, or epidemiological advice. So the fact that it's rolled up in sexuality and ethics and morals and all the rest of it makes it a very juicy subject.
Well, one of the things that really got my attention with this was actually I love the willpower discussion that comes up in the book. It's one of my favorite sections, actually. I like the way it's dealt with, and speaking as a person who's dealt with obesity, I could really empathize with both sides of the discussion. It sounded like an argument that I had myself a number of times, but. When you look at what's presented there, and even with the downside, I wonder if the cure, as presented in the book, wouldn't be considered by a lot of people to be worth it. I mean, I know that the gut answer is no, but
so to speak.
Pardon the pun, right? But one of the characters in the book would have probably been single and alone his whole life without that. Right, and I know of people who've dealt with obesity that would willingly trade 10 years of being thin and accepted for 30 years of being shunned and alone. So I mean, it's a really interesting calculus that you get into with those kinds of issues.
Well, sure, and I don't think that's actually speculative at all. I mean, the things like gastric bypass are pretty certain to take several years off of your life. I mean.
Yeah.
Or having, eating tapeworms or crash dieting or certainly like taking amphetamine. We understand pretty clearly that amphetamine is free. amphetamine costs something in the long term in terms of your health. But even an act, right, which, you know, is how I lost all my weight, it's pretty clear, I think, from the evidence that, that a very, very high protein diet that's very low in very high in animal protein and very low in other kinds of macronutrients has some long-term health effects. It's one of the reasons I don't do it anymore. But I was confronting the fact that I had back problems, I had other problems that were a direct result of my weight, and I said to myself, possibly with a certain degree of self-serving justification, that losing that weight was offset any of the costs that would arise from the method by which I was losing it. And I don't think I'm the only one.
No.
I think that's a very common idea. It'll be interesting to see if the statistics ultimately back that up. I don't think they do for an awful lot of the methods that get tried. But then you end up eat less than exercise, right? So.
Yeah.
So Stephen, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I've been a little quiet, but I'm here. One exciting thing about Makers is basically there's this idea that, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, the means of production have been centralized. And all of a sudden, you know, we're seeing a future where everything's decentralized. It's already happened in publishing and things like that, but now with physical goods, you say in the novel at one point, every industry that required a factory yesterday only needs a garage today. So I guess my question is, Makers reads in some ways like it's happening right now, in other ways it's 5-10 years in the future. Are we at the beginning of the Makers world right now?
I think, I don't think I'm making any predictions, because I think I'm kind of trying to tell parables about the present. So guess that's true. I mean, I think we're already living to some extent in that world. I think that there's some really interesting parallels between what makes Makers good for me and why I'm interested in steampunk. There's a magazine called Steampunk Magazine whose motto is love the machine, hate the factory. And I think that this is a really exciting idea because, you know, I don't have a lot of time for backstab the landers, right? People who want to live more simply because, you know, one of the hidden assumptions under Live More Simply is that all we need to do is reduce the population of the planet by 3/4 so that we can go back to, you know, tilling the land by hand. Because anything else isn't going to work.
That.
So, yeah, exactly. So, you know, your pastoral lifestyle shouldn't require an act of genocide unseen in human history as a starting condition. But I understand at least some of the appeal of living that way. And I think one of the appeals of living in an artisanal fashion, in a pre-industrial fashion, is that industrial living is it takes away a lot of your autonomy, and in exchange for your autonomy, it gives you efficiency. So the number of labor and materials inputs into a factory, a quantity of labor and material input into a factory will produce more output than the same labor and materials put into a bunch of artisanal workshops, into artisanal workshops. And for that reason alone, artisans just didn't stand a chance. They were just obliterated by the fact that factories could just make more for less. And that's how we got to our current population. It's why Malthus turned out to be wrong. It's not a bad thing. But it's a bad thing on this micro scale, where if you're an artisan and you're, you know, working in your wood shop and you're making a door, and you might go, you know, the weather outside is beautiful, and it smells great out there because the leaves have just turned, and I don't want to be in here varnishing and getting that smell up my nose. I'm going to go outside and sand. And you get to do that, right? And you get to have the life where you maximize your happiness, but you do it at the expense of your productivity. And eventually you're stuck making doors that no one can afford because everyone else's doors now cost, you know, a thousandth of what yours do, because instead of having factory workers or, you know, artisans who get to say, today I work outside, they have factory workers who make one very precise sand stroke or brush stroke or press one button on a machine every 18 seconds, And in this way, they can pile up doors faster than you know you could ever hope to do it. And so unless you're paying yourself, you know, a millionth of a cent an hour, your doors will always cost more than theirs and won't be appreciably better. So I think what steampunk and what 3D printing and making promise is some of that efficiency, but without the loss of autonomy, with the ability to choose how you work and where you're going to work, and you know, to be able to throw away some of the stuff that none of us ever really liked about industrial culture, unless you know we happen to be the boss in the foreman's office and not the grunt on the line. And I think that's the thing that I'm very excited about. And I think that's if there's one trend that I think we see a lot of people groping towards, it's this idea of high productivity with a high degree of individuality,
where every product could be like made to order in a way. Yeah,
well, and you can do a lot of stuff for yourself, and you can do a lot of stuff with people around you on, you know, there's, like, I think markets are pretty cool, and I think markets are really interesting in the ways that they find to very efficiently allocate and organize scarce resources. But I don't think, I think that there's lots of resources that aren't scarce that don't need markets, and that don't benefit. You know, I think organizing a non-scarce resource is really dumb, right? It's like deciding which grains of sand you get to build castles out of and which grains of sand I get to organize, build castles out of on the beach. I mean, you can do that. I'll be over here making sand castles. Thank you very much. And I also think that there's lots of stuff that we don't have any real evidence markets solve very well. Like, you know, you don't have I think, you know, even the most viciously externally capitalistic corporation, a lot like a Soviet bureaucracy on the inside, right? You know, why did you get that desk and not your coworker? Well, because from each to his ability, to each according to his need, not because your boss held a spot auction for that desk, right?
Right.
And same with families, same with you know, faith, same with the military, right? All right, grunts, I want you to go over that hill. Sarge, I'll give you $1 not to go over that hill. You know, we don't use markets to organize all kinds of incredibly important things, and because markets tend to be pretty adversarial, there's a lot of things that we can organize very efficiently in markets that leave us feeling kind of stressed out or not very happy. And I think that one of the promises of a kind of maker world is that we don't need to use markets to organize a lot of it, because a lot of it isn't scarce. A lot of it doesn't need organization, or at least not organization the way that markets organize things.
Well, this kind of leads us to a question about this discussion we're having is part of we're doing a three-part series on our podcast about, we're calling it The New Economy, and we're also talking with Martin Ford.
I think that one's already taken by the web, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But we borrow things. We
okay.
Research things. We'll
right.
Spell new differently. We'll spell it Andy
right.
Or something. But
right.
I think that's been taken too. Comes anyway.
Mixed bird.
Yeah. I don't know if you know Martin Ford. His book Lights in the Tunnel.
No, I don't know it.
Okay, so he describes keeping the consumer economy alive post this period where structural unemployment puts everybody out of work. And the way you keep the consumer economy alive is basically there's a few companies left that hold all the marbles, and we'll tax the daylights out of those companies, and then we'll have a kind of government system where we're going to pay citizen consumers to be educated, to be environmentally responsible, to engage in positive behaviors. Now, what do you make of that kind of scenario in terms of just likelihood? And based on having read Makers, I'll give you a totally loaded question here. Do you think we end up in a huge welfare state, or do we end up in a big luxury shanty town ultimately, or does it go some other direction?
Well, I think some other direction is almost always the answer when you're making predictions about the future, just because, you know, the future is always weirder than we imagine, right? We're always stuck with, you know, just like this, only more so, or just enough change to benefit us, and then it'll stop, you know, like the two major fallacies of the future, right? Oh, music fans lasers will get cheap enough that music fans will put CD players in every room and will sell all those LPs one more time, but CPUs won't continue getting cheap to the point where they can just copy those CDs and put them on the internet, you know,
right.
Just enough and not too much. And the other one is, of course, the horseless carriage. You know, the technology will change, but it'll be just like today, only more so. So I think the third is that's the correct answer. As to whether we'll get a giant welfare state, I mean, I think that the dichotomy between welfare state and free market is vastly overstated, right? I mean, I throw my lot in with the people who say that without the state, there's no property. It is only the capacity of the state to defend property interests that keeps us from that allows you to say that this house is mine and to have it still be yours when you get back to it at the end of the day. And by the state, I mean very broadly, not just government, but also the social contracts that give rise to it. I mean, I don't think that the reason my neighbors don't break into my house is because they can't figure out how to smash my window or because they fear being arrested. I think the reason they don't do it is because of the social contract. But I kind of include that in the state, and social contracts attenuate the further away you get. So, you know, maybe my neighbors don't smash my window because we have a social contract, but some total stranger junkie doesn't smash my window for lots of other reasons too. So I guess I think that we're already in that welfare state, right? We're already in a state in which you need to redistribute, in which first the state creates wealth, and then it takes some of it, and then it redistributes it in order to try and find some optimum or some maximum. We can all disagree about what the optimum or maximum position is, but it's that optimum or maximal position is I think inevitably the creation of the state, you know, much as I think a lot of people would prefer it not to be. I think it has to be, right? I mean, otherwise you've got Somalia, right? Basically the only thing you can own is that which you can ring with guns and then command the loyalty of the men who point them at everyone else. And I think apart from that, you need a state.
Okay. With that thought in mind,
that may have been a little bit too maybe a little bit too orthogonal to the main axis of movement here, but there you go.
I think it's really interesting, particularly when you incorporate the notion of the state into the or when you incorporate the idea of the social contract and just really the whole kind of civilization into the state. But at that point the welfare state versus the free market. There's a lot of tension supposedly between those two things. But so I think it's interesting to kind of define those on a continuum. But I love the shantytown model in the book. I've spent a lot of time in other parts of the world. I lived in Southeast Asia for a number of years, and I've had the opportunity to view shanty towns up close, and they're this interesting combination of something that is very sad and something that is very wonderful at the same time. Is my observation. The sad part being that often you'll see hygiene and safety and other conditions that you would not wish for people, particularly children. And the wonderful thing is that you see people build a town, right? And you see them take what they have available, and they make a place for themselves, and they make a home for their family to the extent that they're able to. Now, in Makers, we see this process enabled by some, you know, I guess really not too terribly futuristic technology at all, but the dynamic of it is exactly, I think, what you see in the developing world when a shanty town forms. Now, I guess my question is, do you see shanty towns as a coming feature of the landscape, or are we still just kind of dealing metaphorically here?
Oh, no, I certainly think that we're going to have a lot of them. If for no other reason, I think the character of urbanization is going to change as a result of environmental changes and also the energy landscape changing. And I think that that's going to create a lot of dead zones and autonomous zones and abandoned zones, and will shift the nexus of power and value around in a lot of the places that we live. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that the shanty town in Makers is on the site of a dead Walmart in an ex-urban or suburban, you know, deep suburban former monster home and condo enclave in Florida near Miami. Because, you know, I think that the model where you drive a car for an hour in each direction to get to where you work is dead and, you know, good riddance too. But I think that upheaval is gonna race ahead of our capacity to develop sustainable housing. And I also think that, you know, here I'm gonna go back and sound like a free marketer and repudiate everything I just said before. I think that people who build communities organically, by and large, do a better job than pre-planned state housing. That if you look at the record on slums that have been bulldozed and replaced by so-called modern hygienic housing, that what you usually end up with is a lower productivity per square foot, more crime and violence, especially against women and vulnerable populations, more dislocation, and so on. And you know, we've seen this in India. We saw this in Jane Jacobs wrote very eloquently about this happening in Chicago when they took what was a notorious Chicago neighborhood. I think it was near the stockyards, and raised it and rebuilt it from scratch in this kind of tabula rasa approach, where you level it out and then you rebuild it without a lot of consultation from the community according to what you believe they need, and what a complete disaster and failure that was too. I think if I believe in shanty towns, it's because I don't believe in tabula rasas. I think that all solutions that start with, well, what we need to do is wipe the slate clean and then start building, sow the seeds of their own destruction, because you can't wipe the slate clean, because there is no slate that doesn't, there is no situation with that hasn't got some good in it, that doesn't have something worth saving. And when you wipe the slate, you do things like dislocate the familial and social relationships that are embodied in a shanty town or in a tent city or in a slum, that are the only asset, maybe, that the people living there have, the only social asset the people living there have. And when you take that away, it's very hard to recoup it or to reclaim it. You know, even badly laid out workplaces, over time, the people who work next to each other will figure out rhythms of working with one another, and kind of the tabula rasa approach to you know, building a new building and moving everyone in and arranging them functionally according to department, you know, I think in corporate history has been a very bad idea and hasn't played out nearly as well as we'd hope. I think that, you know, there's always someone for whom a completely fresh start is not the best idea. And then those resentments simmer and the scars are always there, and there is no such thing as a perfectly smooth, clean start. And so that's why I think we'll have that kind of informal living that when we race ahead of our capacity to house everyone, as opposed to, oh, let's just bulldoze this and put something new here. I mean, London's a really nice example of this. London's kind of built on top of other Londons and beside other Londons and around other Londons. And the places where they bulldozed and started clean are the worst places. You know, there's a lot of stuff in London that we think of as being post-war, and we say, oh, well, you know, this was bombed in the Blitz. When you actually look up the record of these parts, it's mostly in East London where I live. When you look up the history of these parts, actually a lot of them weren't. A lot of them are near bomb sites that were deliberately or accidentally neglected, and then rapacious developers came along and said, well, these beautiful old historic neighborhoods, I'd like to pull them down to level ground and build cheap, what the Germans call Neubauten, new buildings, you know, cheap, crappily built 1960s unlovely buildings, and just sort of smack them up overnight and see how much I can maximize my gain from this property. And as a city, you know, those places remain kind of really crummy and not very good. And the bits around them that were spared that actually came back to life on their own in a way that's very satisfying and organic. So, you know, I think that tabula rasas, we should always be suspicious of them.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite lines in the book is, if I could just read you a little bit of your own writing, if that's okay. You write, the facade revealed the tragedy of the USSR's unrequited love affair with concrete. Having spent time in Russia, I've seen that up close. And now there's an interesting contrast, because there you have the state, or even in London where they put up the new development, everything that happened there happened within the auspices of the social contract and the state, maybe not necessarily the social contract. We'll keep those two separate for now. And the shantytown model, it would seem to me, because there's issues around who owns the property and, you know, do these people pay taxes and all this, all these questions are asked in the book, seems to actually sit outside of that model just a bit. So, Is it a clean, bright line between the state and the independent streak that lets people build shanty towns, or do those two ideas somehow fit together?
Gosh. Yeah, now you understand why I'm not running for office, because I don't have that answer. I don't have that answer. I mean, I think that, what does a good parent do? What does a good boss do? A good parent or a good boss looks at what's working well and helps you institutionalize it so that it's protected and so that it can continue to grow. You know, this is what I do with my kid. This is what the people I've worked for I've never been a very good boss, but the people who've been my best bosses said, okay, you're doing this really well. I'm going to make sure that the organization stays out of your way while you do it, or even better, supports you while you do it. And I think that's what a good state does too, right? A good state is about facilitating that which works well. And then where things don't work, trying to figure out who's doing something that might work there and nurturing it a little. I'm suspicious of things that start from scratch that say, you know, the state has identified a problem, so it identifies the program to solve it. I think that it's almost never the case that we have a problem that someone isn't doing something that might solve. I think the question is figuring out who's doing it and having them apply it to more than one place. Does that answer your question? It may not be a very satisfying answer.
No, I think that addresses it exactly, because when I look at the dichotomy between those two, going back to Martin Ford's kind of pristine welfare state, which is almost a tabula rasa in its own right, and the shantytown as described in Makers, you know, I put it to myself this way. Well, if I could stay here in my nice suburban house in Colorado, and I get a check every month for being a good environmental citizen from the government and continuing my education, or I could go live in the shantytown as described in the book, I'd be inclined to actually want to go live in the shantytown, although I haven't checked with my wife. She might she might actually give a completely different answer. So I think there's a lot that has to be worked out between those two models. Stephen, what's next on the agenda?
Well, I wanted to ask Corey. Corey, you mentioned your latest novel, which is not Makers. You've worked on a new novel. Tell us just a little bit about the new work. Is it a sequel to Makers, or is it something totally new? What are you working on, or what have you just finished?
Well, generally speaking, I don't do sequels. I don't have the attention span for them by and large. So I'm one of the things that makes writing really exciting for me is inventing new stuff, and so going back over old territory I find really kind of less satisfying. So what I've just finished working on, beg your pardon, I just blew my buffer there. What I've just finished working on is a book called For the Wind, and it's my second young adult novel. And it's not a sequel to Little Brother, but it follows some of the same form, in that it's a book about a techno-social issue that uses a kind of cracking adventure story where people are running around doing all kinds of exciting things to explain some really complicated ideas. So in this case, For the Wind is about people all over the world, particularly in Asia, but also in the U.S. and Russia and South and Central America, who work in video games. And some of them work in video games lawfully. Some of them are, you know, there's a guy who's the chief economist of a giant virtual economy. Some of them work in games lawfully, but not very loftily. So there's a kid who's a mechanical Turk for a video game, and his job is to supply dialogue for non-player characters when people ask questions that aren't in the canned response list. And then there's some people who work on the outside of the system, and they're gold farmers. They're people whose job it is to do repetitive in-game tasks in order to amass wealth, gold and swords and so on, that are then sold on to rich players who don't have the patience to sit in front of their computer, you know, killing rats all day. And this is a real thing. Gold farming, at some estimates, employs up to 400,000 people, mostly in China these days. And it's not something that the games really like very much, and it's something that has a lot of juicy and weird nuances or inflections, in that there's a lot of racism in the critique of gold farming. So, you know, people call them Chinese gold farmers. People who are Chinese players who just talk in Chinese and World of Warcraft are often, subject of terrible racial slurs because it's believed that they must be gold farmers. But, of course, the customers for Chinese gold farmers are not Chinese players. by and large, they're you know, Western white players, the same ones who are so upset about Chinese gold farmers, a little, you know. And so that's the basic setup of the book. And against this backdrop, the Chinese gold farmers decide to start a trade labor union. And the way that they do that, they call it the Industrial Workers of the World Wide Web, or Weblies. And the way and the thing that makes it possible to organize an independent union that's very successful, where up until now they haven't been very successful in countries like China, is that they can sneak around behind their boss's back and behind the government's back by being on the internet, by being in the game. And, you know, the game is, and because they're already using the game in a way that's calculated to be difficult to track because they want to avoid their bosses, or want to avoid the game masters, they're also set up very well to avoid their bosses. And so it's a kind of cracking adventure story, because part of it is set in these games, and there's, you know, bits where people in giant mechas are killing each other, and there's bits where people, you know, are running around Nintendo Mushroom Forest killing each other and fighting each other with, you know, flying turtles. And then there's also parts where, you know, people are running around the back streets of Guangzhou and Shenzhen and Singapore and Orange County, you know, hitting each other with baseball bats and you know, setting fire to each other's union halls and so on. So there's a lot of in-world and out-of-world stuff. And the book itself uses the device of games and virtual economies to explain macroeconomic ideas like credit default swaps and behavioral economics and the myth of the rational consumer and so on. It was really fun to write.
Well, it sounds fascinating, at the same time, you've got this adventure story going on, and you're explaining macroeconomic policies. You've got a story of a movement, which is one of the things I wanted to ask you about Makers. A very interesting scene to me in the book, where the leader of a growing cult movement, I'll try not to give away too much of the, spoil too much of the plot of the book for those who haven't read it, but this leader of a growing cult movement, he meets the originators of the object of his cult, and he's very disappointed when he comes to realize that they don't see the world the way he does at all, and aren't really engaged by or at all interested in his worldview. Now, and that character, you know, he goes through some terrible things in the book, but that's when I felt the most sorry for him, I have to say, is when he suddenly had that huge disappointment of realizing that he got to Oz and there was a guy behind the curtain, right? As a science fiction author, is this something that you've encountered firsthand?
Well, it's actually something where it's also something where I think some of the healthiest relationships between fans and writers exist, and that's when fans recognize that their relationship is with the work is independent of the writer, and that, you know, the writer's foibles, sins, or even virtues aren't really important to the way that the work spoke to them. And, you know, my favorite example of this, there's a really wonderful writer named Poppy Zed or Z Bright, depending on what side of the continent you're on, Poppy Z Bright. And Poppy started off writing these really groovy, gothy, sexy vampire novels, all set in and around New Orleans. And they were a major smash in the field, and they really shook things up, and they're really well-loved and deservedly so. And then she started writing something else. She started writing books about cooking in New Orleans. Not cookbooks, but really, really lovely, really smart novels about cooking. And the books about cooking are not anything like the books about vampires, and more power to her for being such a versatile writer with lots of different things that she wants to write and say. But her vampire fans like her vampire books and not her cooking books.
Right.
And so there's a LiveJournal community where they were all sitting around talking about how much they liked her vampire books and how much better they were than her cooking books. And she came along to say, no, you don't understand, my cooking books are really great. And they locked her out of it. They said, this is a Poppy Z. Bright fan group. Poppy Z. Bright isn't welcome.
Oh, wow.
And you know what? The more I think about that, the saner it is. Because, you know, what if the corollary of that is that Poppy Z. Bright isn't obliged to come to all those fan groups, that the fans are doing it for themselves, that the fans, that the thing that they're doing is they're gathering around a work in order to have a conversation, and that's great. That's what we write it for. And we don't scale. We can't be in the middle of every one of those conversations. You know, we can't. So we are. I think that that's the best way for things to proceed is for people to say, you know, I love this book. There are lots of other people who love it. I can talk about it with them. My enjoyment of the book does not require that the author of the book sit down and talk with me about it, because chances are, if the author's anything like me, a lot of the author's engagement with the work ended about a year ago when he finished writing it. You know, that's for me, you know, a lot of writing is about working at ideas for myself and both emotional and technical. And when I'm done with the book, I tend to have, you know, worked those ideas out. I can talk about them, but for me, I'm talking about something that happened in the distant past. And for fans, it's stuff that they're going through right now. And so it's maybe not the best matched conversation to have. I mean, you know, no writer objects to hearing from a fan how much he liked, you know, the book. But I don't think that fans need necessarily to have that conversation.
Interesting stuff. It's a great story, too. Stephen, anything else for Corey?
Yeah,
I know we're very close on our time.
Yeah, we are running out of time, Corey, but I wanted to ask you real quick. You've been a supporter of open source, but you also live it. Makers and your other novels are for sale, but at least Makers and I think a couple of others are also available in digital form for free. Has this been a positive experience?
All of them.
All of them.
All my books, with the exception of the first book that I wrote, which I co-wrote with someone else for a packager. It was The Idiot's Guide to Publishing Science Fiction. But everything else, every other book I've ever written, is licensed as a free Creative Commons download, and the license includes the right to remix it. So that's characteristic of all my work. I find it artistically satisfying. I mean, let's start with artistic satisfaction. I find it artistically satisfying to make art in the 21st century that's intended to be copied, partly because it's not very realistic to assume otherwise. I mean, I think it's not going to get harder to copy stuff from here on in, unless something truly catastrophic happens, you know, in technology and civilization as we know it. From here on in, you know, hard drives get more capacious and smaller and cheaper, and networks get faster and easier to use. And so if you're making art that you don't intend people to copy, it's anachronistic, right? It's like, I don't know, it's like being the blacksmith at Pioneer Village or something. I mean, maybe that's your thing, but it's, you know, it's not contemporary art. So making art that people are allowed to copy has made great sense to me. Making art that people are allowed to copy has also made a lot of moral sense to me, because of course I'm a copier, you're a copier, I've always been a copier. When I was, you know, 14 years old, we would pool our money, my friends and I, to buy a copy of Asimov's, and we would find out whose dad had access to a photocopier at work, and they'd make copies of the best stories and we'd share them around. You know, when I was a teenager, it was mixtapes that kept me from being entirely celibate. You know, I've always been a copier, and to go around telling, especially kids, but, you know, people in general, oh, copying is bad, it's just hypocritical, especially given that in the name of stopping illicit copying, we're now, you know, on the verge of institutionalizing internet censorship and surveillance, and redesigning our computers so that they spy on you to stop you from making copies and so on. So, you know, I certainly morally it feels like the right thing. And luckily for me, it's not only morally and artistically satisfying, it turns out to be commercially viable too. I don't have any way to prove that I sell more books because I give them away, although, you know, as Tim O'Reilly says, for most writers, the problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. You know, I think to do that right controlled experiment, I would have to go back in time and re-release the same books without the CC license and then see how the sales compare. But certainly my books outsell the bets that are put on them by publishers in the form of print runs, and they surprise pleasantly my editor, my agent, and everyone who's kind of around them. So, you know, Little Brother, 90,000 hardcovers in print, sold into 17 languages and 18 markets. The film rights sold to the guy who made Transformers. It was a New York Times bestseller, and it was free from the day it hit the stands. So it's, you know, that to me suggests that if I'm wrong and I'm losing sales, I'm not losing more sales than I can afford. Good. You know, I'm certainly that, like, at these days, at this rate, you know, if I can sell 90,000 hardcovers and bring home a you know, $1 to $2 royalty on each one of them, on a book that I write, and if I can write a book every year or so, you know, whatever sales I'm losing, if you assume that I am, I can live with.
Well, we hope you do continue to. Go ahead, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I tell you that I read it for free, but I'm going to give. You know, you can't. you can't give it as a gift if I'm going to give a free copy to somebody. So what I'm going to do is buy a couple of copies for birthday presents that are coming up. So that's the way it's working out for me. So anyway.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have a donate program too. Cause one of the things that I get a lot of is people writing to me and saying, can I donate, can I give you money? I kind of don't want your $5 because I don't have any way to account for it, and the tax stuff is a nightmare, and my publishers put a lot of money into it, and I don't want them to start feeling like I'm cutting them out of the loop, and you know, that and a million other reasons. I would much rather you buy the book if you want to reward me. And so I recognize that there are a group of people who don't want to buy the book but do want to reward me. And so for those people, I've come up with what I think is a really cool solution. I solicited from librarians and teachers and other people who work in institutions where books are needful. I asked them to put their names forward as wanting free copies of the book. And then I have a page on my website for makers. It's craphound.com/makers/donate, where you can go to donate a copy of the book, and you pick out who you want to give a book to, and you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your local bookseller, and you have a copy sent to them, and you let me know, and we take their name down off the site, or we cross it out. We put a little thank you to you. And we give away hundreds and hundreds of books this way. And when we do it, we end up with, like, schools and libraries having copies of the book. And I get the sales credit so that my publisher and the distributors and the retailers keep their orders high because they like to order more books if they're selling lots of books. And I get the money, and you get to make a donation. And, you know, it's all the way around it. I mean, it's terrific all the way around. So I'm really happy with how that's worked out. A friend of mine called it or a reader wrote into me and said that this is pay it forward with instant gratification. You know, this is the idea that you pay your debts forward. You know, when someone does something nice for you, you do something nice for someone else, but with instant gratification, so you get it right away.
Well, that's a terrific model. I hope you do continue to write a book every year. Hope that you get plenty of readers free, and that people continue to purchase and give your books. Corey, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program. Thank you so much for your time, and continued success to you.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you guys.
Thank you, Corey.
All right. Music this week is from Esteban. Again, he returns this week, and the music is Shanty Mansion.
Hail kids living in the distance, on the tips of existence. Hail kids, light your lanterns, welcome to my shanty mansion. I've got no money, I gave it to you. I've got no money, so I've got nothing to lose. I've got no money, what's mine is yours. I've got no money, catch the paper tree before it falls. I've got no money, so hold me tight. I've got no money, can't move me. I've got no money, I've done nothing wrong. I've got no money, I'm here to stay. I've got no money, from the edge I pray. I've got no money. Got no money. To my shanty mansion.